So, yes, thanks everybody for coming. It's amazing. I've had the occasion to do a few of these and just to do real life. So how did I get to be saying these things? And obviously we all have our long story. And I'll just tell you two stories. One is, I would admit, mostly about me, and the second one is about science. And one of my favorite sayings for years is, the trouble with science is not very scientific. So the first one is, I grew up in a sort of normal house. You know, my father was a dentist, my grandfather was a dentist. You know, they vaccinated me and fed me horrible food, and they didn't get along very well and all this. But my mother was a really wonderful person. She was one of the nicest people I've ever met, and very kind. And Sally has actually met her, and I think might even agree. But her favorite saying, and something she said to me all the time, was, if you don't have anything good to say, don't say anything. I heard that over and over again. So, of course, being me, I didn't say anything until I was about 7. Right? I mean, you know, from what I was seeing, I probably tried to think of some good things, but I couldn't. And so I just... And then I went to first grade, and the teacher said, you know, he doesn't say anything. And they took me to a child psychiatrist. I actually know the guy's name, Maury Weiss. And I don't know what happened there, because I imagine I didn't say anything. But he said, don't worry about him. He's just thinking a lot. Someday he might say something. And I'm still to this day grateful to Maury for, you know, not, I didn't go back, nothing happened. And anyways. So that was the first story. Even to this day, you know, we've had a number of conversations on the feedback of how I give presentations with my wife and other people, and, you know, like, stop sort of denigrating other people and saying bad things about people. And I totally get that. That's wonderful advice, and I think there's still something in me that's like, yeah, but then I won't say anything. So that isn't going to work. Anyways, I'm going to do my best. The second story, I think, that describes something about this. So I grow up, you know, normal. Most of my family's friends were doctors. So I grew up around doctors. And some of them were very interesting, sort of high-powered doctors. The guy who invented the laser for gynecology was a good friend of my family and a few other ones. And all I knew was I don't know what I wanted to do with my life, but I did not want to be a doctor. I didn't like something about the whole thing. I didn't like the way they thought, and I just didn't want to do it. So I go to university, but I was a good student, you know. So I go to university. I went to Duke, and I didn't like it there. So I graduated in 3 years, and I did talk by then, by the way. But so in my third year, I was a junior. I was lucky enough to get into a class. I still remember the professor's name was Dr. Nichols. And he had been Duke University Teacher of the Year at least 3 times, maybe more. And he was a wonderful teacher, and he was a molecular biologist with a specialty in the folding of proteins and DNA. And whether you know what that means or not doesn't really matter. And so he had a graduate level course, and I somehow got permission to get into that course. So there's about 25 people in the room, and he didn't teach all the classes, but he came in to teach this one. And I actually heard that he was nominated for a Nobel Prize for discovering how DNA is folded up, right? So this is a big shot in science. So he comes into the room, and it was probably half the size of this room, and he had like things sort of like coat hangers on 4 corners of the room. And The issue was, if you look at a cell when it's dividing, you see chromosomes, right? Those dark things that look like this. Everybody knows what I mean. And then when the cell is not dividing, you don't see any DNA. It's just gone. And the question was, how does... So in the reason you don't see it is because it's unfolded, and so it's now just a long string, so that it can be made into RNA and protein, right? So it can't be all folded up because you can't get at it and make it into protein. So the question is, how does it get from this long string into these tiny little chromosomes? And so he sets up this station and he puts a string four times around the room, right? So that's the unfolded DNA. And then he has a thimble about this big. And he said that if it was to scale, the string would be 10 times around the room, but he didn't want to do it 10 times. He just did it four times. Everybody with me? So then, and he's a real enthusiastic speaker, and you can see why he was Teacher of the Year. So he gets one end of the string and he starts folding it and putting it into the thimble, because that's sort of mirroring what's happened. And he gets about 1.5 times around, and he's got a stick now, and he's stuffing it in the thimble, and he can't get any more string in the thimble. And he's still got 3.5 times more, and supposedly another 8 to go. And he's stuffing it in. And then he says, and isn't it amazing that nature can do this, put this much string, DNA, into this size chromosome, and we don't really understand how that happens. But it's the mystery of life is amazing. And literally at that point, everybody in the room, except me, got up and like cheered, like, the mystery of life, we have discovered it. And I still remember where I was sitting in the back right in the class, and I said something to myself like, what the hell? He just proved that you can't do that. And of course, I didn't say anything. You know, the guy was going to get a Nobel Prize for discovering how to do this. And all I could think of was, this is why I don't like science. Because he has a theory, and he tried to demonstrate the theory, and it clearly doesn't work, and it made no difference. He just said there must be some magical way that it folds, which he has no clue, even though the guy's like 60 and he's been doing this for 30 years, and he's the world leader in how this particular process works. And so then I joined the Peace Corps and taught gardening. I said, this is nuts. And of course, I didn't know anything. Like, I didn't know what happens to the DNA and what happens to the chromosomes, and I have an idea now. But anyways, that's not the subject. But anyways, so then we go on, and then 1 year or so ago, after all this time, in even though I'd been part of the HIV doesn't cause AIDS movement, so I'm no stranger to this idea of viruses since 1986 or so. I stuck my foot in my mouth, said, viruses don't cause disease. They're just garbage excreted from the cell. And then I got hammered by just about everybody. And I thought to myself, I better figure this out. And so after a year and I don't know how many interviews, I'm going to tell you how to figure this out. Now, the other thing I'm going to say here is about 2 weeks ago, I had the occasion to... how many of you know Andy Kaufman? Yeah. So when I speak now, it'll become clear maybe. I typically I speak and then he speaks. It works better that way. So we were invited by the leaders of the world of freedom movement and to give a presentation on there's no virus, no pathogenic viruses. And they were very, I would say, antagonistic. And there was a couple of virologists and a bunch of other doctors, and they invited a virologist who turns out to be a pathologist who had spent 20 years as a senior pathologist virologist for the Chinese Center for Disease Control in Wuhan, and then 20 years as a Yale University pathologist with a specialty in laboratory virology. And he was invited to debunk Andy and I and say that we were idiots and that science we were presenting was incorrect. And I thought, well, this is going to be interesting because if anybody should know, I mean, this guy should know, as well as the other virologists and the other internists who were very vocal in saying that we were incorrect. And the reason I say that is because I'm going to say some things here, and I'm going to say that he and they all agreed with me. And I will show you the exact point that they didn't agree with me. And so therefore, the idea that I'm wrong because of these steps, which I'll tell you, is not correct. Because we all agree on everything until one point. And you are going to understand this point as much as you understand how to make a bread and butter toast for breakfast. And so when I say, I want you to know, how does a virologist prove the existence of a new virus and show it causes disease? I'm not looking for jargon. I'm looking for like how you would make a loaf of bread. You get flour, you mix it with water, you put salt, you knead it, you put it in an oven at 350, you bake it for 30 minutes, you put it on a rack, and then you eat it. That clear, because once you see that clear, you will know that the whole theory that viruses are pathogens, i.e., disease-causing entities, is nonsense. And if you don't see that, if you don't understand the steps, you will walk out of here confused. And I don't want that. And the idea that this doesn't matter to what's happening, I just cannot wrap my mind around. Because if there's no virus and viruses don't cause disease, then what are we wearing masks for and what are we injecting people with? And why are we keeping people social distance? And why are we closing businesses? And on and on and on. This is, to me, the linchpin. So no matter how many people tell me, don't be divisive, don't say this, people will never understand it. It's not true. You will all understand it in now 30 minutes. So let's get to it. First of all, if you ask, and by the way, I would say 99% of medical doctors, and I would love it if you all check me on this. Go to your family doctor, ask him just that question, or her. How do you show the existence of a virus, prove that it causes disease? They won't know. If you ask most people, how do you know the existence of a virus and it causes disease? They say, a lot of people got sick in the same place, therefore it must be a virus. Or they say, a lot of people got sick here, and then it started spreading to this next place, so it must be a virus. Or they say, there was nobody sick in San Quentin, and then they put somebody went there who tested positive, and then they all got sick, or they all tested positive, so it must be a virus. Or my Aunt Bessie went to church, and she wasn't sick, and then she got sick, so it must be a virus. These are called epidemiological observations. If you think that because a lot of people got sick in the same place, that proves it's a virus, you must think that Hiroshima was a virus. If you think that because a lot of people got sick in the same place and then it spread to another place, you must think that Chernobyl was a virus. And if you think that because people in the same proximity get sick, it must be a virus. For 200 years, they noticed that sailors on ships got sick, their teeth fell out, they went into heart failure and died, one after another. And then the next boat that went out, also they got sick. And for 200 years, they thought that was a contagious disease that they couldn't say anything. They couldn't find the pathogen. And then somebody ate a lime and the whole thing went away because it was scurvy. And this has happened with beriberi. It happened with pellagra. All of these, they thought it was a contagious disease that we couldn't find the pathogen. And then somebody ate B vitamins and the whole thing went away. There is no scientist, no virologist, no competent medical doctor who thinks you can use epidemiological observations to prove viral causation, period. And I don't need anybody to say, well, but somebody got sick or they were fine and then they went to a party and they got sick or my friend got sick. All those are observations. And the purpose of those is to generate hypotheses, which then you can test to find out what happened. And I can tell you right now, after hearing hundreds of stories like that, I don't need one more story to think that we should have investigated to see whether it was a virus. Right? I got that. Of course, there is a lot of other things that we could have investigated too, and I won't get into that right now. But nobody of any scientific competence thinks that's proof of viral existence or that it causes disease. So we don't need to say that. Everybody got that? Okay, next step. Now we get into how we should prove viruses exist and cause disease versus how we do prove it. So next step, you ask most medical doctors, scientists, medical doctors, scientists, and lay people, how do you demonstrate the existence of a new virus and it causes disease? So you take a bunch of people with the same symptoms, right? They have a cough, they have fever, they have a runny nose, their oxygen is low, or they broke their leg, or whatever it is. They all have the same clinical symptoms or close enough. They all have measles. They all have chicken pox, right? And I would say if it's an important situation, you take a lot of those people, like 500 of them, and you take some bodily fluid from them, many bodily fluids, blood, urine, saliva, snot, bronchial alveolar lavage. That's when you stick a bronchoscopy tube and you suck out their lung fluid. You could take all the fluids you can from a person. And then you have a sample from all 500 or 100 or 20 of those people. They all have the same sickness. They all have measles. You take their lung fluid, and then you go looking for the virus, right? So how do you do that? Now, some of you may have heard, but there's an analogy here. If you wanted to find whether coffee beans have caffeine, it's very similar. First thing you do, let's take a lung fluid as an example. Could be any of those. So let me back up here. What we're looking for is a virus, right? A virus is a piece of protein with a genetic material in the inside, either DNA or RNA, right? The other thing I want to point out is a virus, and see if anybody disagrees with me, is a thing, meaning it's a real particle, they say. Not a feeling, not a thought, not a conception, not an idea. Nobody's saying that. They say it's a particle that you can see. Fine. It's a protein, DNA, or RNA interior. And it should find identical thousands of copies of this particle, same protein, same morphology, same structure, same DNA or RNA, same sequence of the DNA and RNA from all these people with, say, measles. So the first thing you do is you put it in a blender, like a coffee grinder. And that's because we say that the viruses are inside the cell, so you have to agitate them, right? To break it down, make it easier to see. Now, that's not just virus, right? That's all the cells and fungus and lung cells and DNA, RNA, proteins, toxins, and viruses in that person's lung, because after all, they're sick. So then you do the next step. You put it through a filter paper, right? And you even know what the size of the pores in the filter paper are, like a coffee filter. And you catch the cells and the fungus and the debris, and you discard that. Just like you get coffee, liquid coffee dripping, you discard the coffee grounds. Everybody with me? It's just very simple. So that's still not pure caffeine, right? That's caffeic acids and a whole lot of other things. That's not a pure virus. That's viruses, that's toxins, that's DNA, that's RNA, and anything else that's soluble in water, right? Nobody disagrees with any of this. So then you put it through an ultracentrifuge, which is a sucrose gradient. It's just like a column, and you spin it around, and you can even say exactly how many RPMs you spin it at, right? And then because of that, it separates out in bands in this column by molecular weight. In other words, everything that weighs 3 pounds is here, everything that weighs 2 pounds is here, everything that weighs 1 pound is there, right? That's called ultracentrifugation. You know, even if you don't know, you can then suck out the band with a pipette, and then you can look at it under an electron microscope, and you should see identical morphology, shape, and size particles, thousands of them. That is called isolated purified virus. And you can do that with caffeine. You take the coffee, ultracentrifuge it. There's other ways, gel, electrophoresis. You don't need to know that. You just need to know there is a centrifuging process that spins things out. All you have is caffeine. You can suck it out. You can do a chemical analysis. You can tell your steps to some other lab. They can do it exactly like you do. They will find only caffeine. Here, you will find only the same size, shape, virus, thousands of them. That's called an isolated, purified virus. Is everybody 100% clear on what I just said? Here's the next step, which I am 100% sure of. That process has never been done for any disease-causing virus ever. All virologists, including the three on that call, agreed with what I just said. Think about that. Whether it's herpes, chickenpox, measles, SARS-CoV-2, Ebola, HIV, Zika, etc., nobody has ever been able to find, isolate, and purify any virus that from any sick person's bodily fluid. Period. I've looked in the medical literature for a year. There is no example of that. All of the virologists, including the Chinese guy from Wuhan, he agreed. We asked him, we said, why did what's up? So there's two reasons they give. Number one, there's not enough virus to see. So I was with Andy, and Andy, being, if you've seen him, he says, there's a thing called a virus concentrator. So you can put 1,000 people together and pool their bronchial fluid. Would you see it then? No. You have to concentrate it. He said, what about 10,000 people? Would there be enough to see it then? He said, no, you have to concentrate it. Andy said, what about 100,000 people? Would there be enough of this SARS-CoV-2 virus to see? Because you could get 100,000 people who we say are positive for COVID. We get their lung fluid, see if we could find the virus. He said, no, there is not enough to see. You have to concentrate it. Right. It's always good. When people laugh, that means they get it. Yeah, right. So there's another reason they said. They said, it's because you, Tom, you can't see viruses like that. Viruses are intracellular, inside the cell pathogens. So, of course, you can't see them outside the cell because they're only inside the cell. So, this gets back to me as a three-year-old, and I'm thinking, you know, okay. I said, yeah, but how does it get from one person to the next? It gets outside the cell, obviously, and then goes to the next person. And I said, well, why don't you get somebody to find it then? And they didn't say anything. And that was the end of the conversation. So once you found the virus, right, you suck it out, you have the band, you have thousands of copies, then you would expose an animal in the normal way, like not injecting it into their brain, but spray it on them like we say this virus is transmitted and see if they get the same disease. Now, that has never happened for the simple reason that nobody ever found the virus in the first place. So they can't possibly do the next step. And because nobody ever found the virus in the first place, you can't possibly have sequenced the genome of this that you haven't found. And you can't possibly have found variants of the genome of a virus that you never found. And by the way, if you don't believe me on this, here's what Christian Drosten said, asked in his paper, do you have the virus? He said, we aim to develop and deploy robust diagnostic methodology for use in public health laboratories without having virus material available. He's the guy who came up with the PCR test. He didn't have an example of the virus. The Robert Koch Institute, which is the CDC of Germany, when asked under a Freedom of Information type request, do you have a paper of the isolation of the SARS-CoV-2 virus? Quote, I am not aware of a paper which purified isolated SARS-CoV-2. The main health laboratory of Australia, when asked under Freedom Information, do they have an example of an isolated virus, SARS-CoV-2, said, ACT pathology does not have the ability to isolate the virus from patient samples. We do not hold any documents pursuant to your request. The CDC said no quantified virus isolates of the SARS-CoV-2 virus are available. This was in June 2020. Nobody has the virus. There's now been about 10 different Freedom of Information requests to all the Commonwealth governments, Canada, Australia, Great Britain. All of them have admitted in writing that they have no isolates, no examples of this virus. The four people who wrote the main papers that started this were asked in writing, did you purify and isolate this virus? Because the title of their paper is The Isolation and Purification of the Virus. And they all admit in writing they have no examples, they did not isolate or purify the virus. There is no dispute about this. So the question then is, why are there, let me take a guess here, approximately 150,000 papers since 1954, including, let me take a guess, 10,000 in the last year, with the title called The Isolation and Purification of Such and Such a Virus. And the 10,000, or I don't know what number I said, I've seen about 50 of them. The Isolation and Purification of the SARS-CoV-2 Virus. And everybody who disputes me sends me these papers. and says, you have to be wrong because all the scientists in the world are saying they've isolated and purified this virus. And so what is the deal, right? That this is the part. So what I said up till now is how it should be done. And so why are they writing these papers that say the isolation and purification, and then they do the genome, and then they do the variants, and et cetera? What are they doing? This is the part you have to know, like making bread. So here's how they do it. Now, the other thing to say is this started in 1954 with a series of papers by a guy named John Franklin Enders, who is given the Nobel Prize in medicine, I think, for the isolation and purification of the measles virus and showing that the measles virus caused measles. This is where this started. Every single paper since 1954 has used the exact same technique that Enders inaugurated in his papers in 1954. And the reason this happened is because when they invented the electron microscope, which is the only way you can see a particle the size of a virus, in around 1935, they spent 20 years looking for virus from sick people and never found one. And so they came to a crossroads as if to say, there's nothing to this. We were wrong. There isn't this pathogen that we can't see. We now can see it. Well, we could see it, but we don't find it. Now, the other important point to note here is one argument that you will hear is the reason you can't find viruses is because you can't do that. You can't find a particle that size. But what happened in 1930 was they took bacterial cultures, and they found that when you stressed and starved bacterial cultures, they broke down into these particles called bacteriophages, bacteria eaters, which are this identical size, genome, and structure of a virus. And they could find them in any bacterial culture. All you have to do is starve and poison a bacterial culture, and it coalesces down into this geometric form called a bacteriophage, and then they isolated and purified it. So it's not a technical problem. They could do this in the 30s. They could do it with so-called giant viruses, which are like spores in sea algae. And my friend, Stefan Lanka, was the first to find, by doing those exact steps, a virus in the sea, in the ocean. So it's not a technical problem of finding them. They just weren't there. And so they probably had a meeting and thought, we should all be plumbers and carpenters because there's nothing to this. And Enders saved the day. So here's what he did. He took one person, one child with measles, not 100, not 500, not 1,000. One child took some of their bronchial secretions. And remember, the game we're playing is find the protein coat with genetic interior, right? That's the game. So the last thing you want to do is confuse the issue by mixing the lung fluid with some other genetic material, right? Then you're screwed. So what does he do? He puts the swab in milk, which is a rich source of genetic material. And I have the paper here that he wrote on this. Then what did he do? He took the swab with this fluid from the person with measles, put it in milk, 2 milliliters of milk, and then he mixed it with penicillin and streptomycin, 2 antibiotics. Then he mixed it with, quote, bovine amniotic fluid, 90%, a rich source of genetic material and proteins and particles. beef embryo extract, horse serum, antibiotics, phenyl red, and soybean trypsin inhibitor. And then he inoculated that, smeared that onto monkey kidney cells. And then the mixture broke down. That's called a cytopathic effect, not the mixture, sorry. You have to be very clear. The Vero cells, the monkey kidney cells, disintegrated. He also took away all the nutrients from the medium, or most of them. It's called minimal nutrient medium. So in other words, you have kidney cells, and you feed them good kidney cell food. And then you start the experiment, and you take away 90% of their nutrients, and you add nephrotoxic, kidney-toxic antibiotics to the mix. Now we use gentamicin and amphotericin, otherwise known as amphoterable, because it destroys kidney tissue. Then we add horse serum, embryonic fluid, fetal cells, etc., and then we get a cytopathic effect. In other words, the monkey kidney tissue breaks down. And that's called the isolation of the measles virus.
Oh my gosh.
The fact that the monkey kidney cell broke down, that's called proof that viruses cause disease. The fact that it breaks down into thousands and millions of little particles is called the isolation of the virus. And every subsequent genome experiment, PCR test, variant is an analysis of the fluid from the broken down tissue. Is that clear? Now, interestingly, Enders, in his original paper, and I'm going to quote it for you, says, quote, I'll interpret this. A second agent was obtained from an uninoculated culture of monkey kidney cells. The cytopathic changes it induced in the unstained preparation could not be distinguished with confidence from the viruses isolated from measles. Here's what happened. He said, well, I better do a control. So he started not with something from anybody with measles. He just did the milk, the antibiotics, the starving, the bovine this, smeared it on kidney cells, and he got the identical result. Think about that. In other words, it had nothing to do with anything from somebody with measles. And then in the follow-up paper, he says, quote, there is potential risk of employing cultures of primate cells for the production of vaccines composed of attenuated virus. Since the presence of other agents possibly latent in primate tissue cannot be excluded by any known method. We have no way, he just said, of saying that these particles we're seeing came from the person with measles or from breaking down of the monkey kidney cells. We have no way of telling the difference. By the way, a live viral vaccine is that steps, right? They take the results of that culture, that's called a viral culture, and they inoculate that, and that's called a live viral vaccine. I don't think everybody got that. So you take the measles person, and you mix it with milk, it's not exactly the same. You mix it with antibiotics, you starve the tissue, you put horse serum, fetal embryonic fluid, smear that on monkey kidney cells, it breaks down, you call that a virus, you call that isolation, you put that in a vial, and then you give somebody a measles shot. And an attenuated virus is they take some of the proteins out of that viral culture, and not the whole thing, and that's called an attenuated viral vaccine. All vaccines are made in this identical way. All of the viral isolation studies, all of the DNA analysis, all of the genome analysis, all of the variants were discovered in exactly this way. Now, that way is a fraud. Now, let me prove that to you. Two things. You could say, well, that was 1954. Surely we know how to tell the difference between the stuff coming from the breakdown of the monkey kidney and all the rest of it from an exogenous outside measles virus, right? Nowadays, we have a fancy name for them called exosomes and extracellular vesicles. That means stuff, particles, coming from us, not from the outside. Here is a paper in a journal called Viruses, May 2020. So this was 8 months ago, the most prestigious journal of the virologists on the problem of extracellular vesicles. And they say the remarkable resemblance between EVs, that's the stuff coming from us, but and viruses has caused quite a few problems in the studies focused on the analysis of EVs released during viral infections. And then there's some more. However, to date, a reliable method that can guarantee a complete separation of EVs, that is stuff coming from us, versus viruses coming from the outside, a complete separation does not exist. There is no way any scientist, virologist, medical doctor can say, this thing which we think is killing you came from the outside versus the breakdown of your own tissue, which inevitably makes all these different particles, which you can see hundreds of them in any slide, and there is no single pathogenic virus from any sick person ever. And finally, we have now proven this. Okay, my friend Stefan Lenka got a laboratory that is one of the European leaders in how to do a viral culture. Is there anybody who doesn't know what I'm talking about now? No. Good. And so for the first time since the 1950s, so here's the only way that a virologist proves that the virus exists and it causes disease. They take the snot from one person, inoculate in the way I just said, see cytopathic effect, means the tissue breaks down. So we got this virology tissue culture specialist to do the following. Column one, this one. A culture with a normal medium, you know, normal growth medium, and a very small dose of antibiotics, just to get them used to it. Nothing happens. Right? The culture's good. It grows. Everything's good. Then they kept the normal culture medium, 10%. That's what that means. And they used one antibiotic. Nothing happens. Then, without adding anything from any sick person, they took away the nutrients, and they now have 1%. And they added the same antibiotic. This 1% is the exact same medium that every study I read on the isolation of SARS-CoV-2, they used this exact same medium. And they added the exact same antibiotics as they used in every single viral culture experiment that I've seen on SARS-CoV-2. Day one, day five, cytopathic effect, exactly the same as you get with SARS if you do a culture with SARS-CoV-2. Exactly the same. The cytopathic effect, which is the way that a virologist says they isolated the virus, shows it caused disease, happens in exactly the same way if you start with nothing from any sick person. And then you can do the same thing And all you add is RNA from yeast. And we will, the next step, which isn't published yet, you are literally the first people to see this, we will show that you can find the entire genome of SARS-CoV-2 in this mix. Just because we added RNA from a yeast. Or we can show that you can find the measles genome in this mix. Or the Zika genome in this mix. Or the HIV genome in this mix. Or any other RNA virus. And all we're going to do is send it to people blindly and say, which virus do you see? Now, I can get into how they find the genome, but I'm a little bit later than I thought. So that gets complicated, so I'm not sure I want to do that. But let me just finish this part. So is this clear what they did? They disproved the central issue in virology, which is the cytopathic effect comes from the technique of the experiment, no virus needed. The entire thing is a house of cards. Yeah, no, not a virus, a cytopathic effect.
So we're proving in number 3 column that this tissue is breaking down and therefore something in this culture is pathogenic.
This picture right here proves that a virus killed the cell. That's what they show in every isolation study that I've seen in the last 60 years. They show the cytopathic effect, meaning you go from this appearance, which is normal cellular appearance, to what are called syncytia. I didn't want to make it so complicated, but the tissue breaks down in a characteristic way, which is proof of the existence of the virus.
But no virus.
Except there was no virus.
They didn't add any virus here. He would say that this proves that the virus killed the cells.
But you can't see the virus.
Of course, you can't see the virus. They don't see the virus. No, they don't see the virus. They see the CPE. They see the cytopathic effect. What? They starved and poisoned it. And they added beef serum and embryonic fluid. They took away the food, and they put two antibiotics, which are the two most kidney toxic poisons there are. And then interestingly, they did this experiment, and they did it with a number of different the CDC did it with human cell lines, and it didn't make any cytopathic effect when they added SARS, you know, the fluid from people with COVID. Because those antibiotics are not, so they used human lung cells. They used a number of different types of human cells, and they didn't get any CPE because those antibiotics are not toxic to lung cells. And so they say, well, all we know is that it only grows on kidney cells, and only if you use kidney toxins. And if you found a lung toxin, it would grow on human lung cells. But using their own method, they proved that there is no cytopathic effect on human cell lines. Now, this is a very important study. Everybody got this? This is the end of the story, yes. Cytopathic effect means you take normal cells, right? And they look like this. And then you kill them, they say the viruses, and they look big and distorted. That is the typical virus pathological effect. It's called, they make syncytia. Yeah.
Is this experimental process, did you say it was originated in 1950?
54.
And is it the same process that's been done since then?
Exactly. The only difference is he used penicillin and streptomycin, and we use gentamicin and amphotericin now because we, quote, get a better yield. And I don't expect anybody to believe me on this, but this is, I mean, let me just say one thing. So here's a study, one of the most important, isolation and rapid sharing of the 2019 novel coronavirus SARS-CoV-2 from the first patient diagnosed with COVID in Australia. This was the first non-Chinese isolation study done. Very important study. They, you know, same thing. Viral culture material from initial nasopharyngeal swab was used to inoculate a VeroSLAM cell line. So you know what's happening now. You know what they did. Now, here's the most important thing. And I'm going to read it, and this will not make sense, and then I'm going to explain it. Quote, electron micrographs of sectioned Vero cells showed cytoplasmic membrane-bound vesicles containing coronavirus particles, see box 5B. Following several failures to recover virions with the characteristic fringe of surface spike proteins, it was found that adding trypsin to the cell culture medium immediately improved virion morphology. Let me explain that. So he did this whole thing that I just explained, and he found these particles, right? And he shows them on his electron microscope picture. Mind you, there's lots of other different particles in this slide. But he points an arrow and he says, those are the SARS-CoV-2 because I can see this characteristic spike protein. You've all seen that, right? But then he says, we didn't get them. They didn't look like the spike protein. So we added trypsin, which is a protein digesting enzyme, and then we could see the spike proteins. In other words, you have this thing which has a protein coat, and so you only see the spiky things if you dissolve the coat. Or, as I said, you want to get a box of wood and you look for star-shaped pieces of wood. But you look and they're all square. So you call your carpenter friend and he cuts out the edges and look, stars. Or as Andy said, you go looking and you see a pig and you stick some feathers on it and look, a chicken. In other words, you don't see the spike protein unless you add trypsin. There is no study that I've seen, and believe me, because I was under the gun on this. I've looked, they all have to add trypsin. Now, here's where it gets really wonky, because then he says, which confused this Australian lawyer, so then we do a genome analysis, and this may be a little bit out of context for you guys, but I think you'll get it. Everybody with me so far? Yes, so I can keep my money, right? You got it. They said, we found that the results of this culture, we did a next generation genome sequencing, and we found a 99% homology match with the original Wuhan genome. In other words, the genome that they found in this was 99% similar to the published genome of the Wuhan virus. That clinches the deal. They found the Wuhan virus. It has approximately 5 billion pieces of RNA and DNA in it. Then they said, okay, we're looking for something. They call this the unbiased de novo next generation sequencing. Unbiased means they're not gaming the system. De novo means anew. They're going to find the genome anew. Next generation is just the name for the new way they find the virus, the sequence of the genome. So they start with 5 billion pieces of RNA and DNA. You would think they would look through this brew and find the genome, right? They don't do that. The first thing they do is they discard the DNA. Now, why do they discard the DNA? Because viruses can be protein with DNA or RNA in them. So why couldn't they have found a DNA virus in this? Well, they were looking for an RNA virus. So they threw away the DNA. And that's called unbiased. And then, so now they go from 5 billion pieces of DNA to 56 million. Approximately. And then they discard all the pieces of RNA, so now you just have RNA, that match humans or other microbes, like bacteria or fungus, based on published databases. Now, mind you, we already know that you can't tell whether a RNA is from a virus from the outside or the breaking down of the U. In fact, we now know that the spike protein sequence has been found 93 different times in the human genome. We know that. But anyways, they threw out all the ones that were published to be part of the DNA of humans or other microbes of the RNA. So now we have 23 million, and that's called an mRNA library. Now, the best way to think of this, I hope you're still with me, is so they started with 5 billion letters and short phrases. And they threw out, I would say arbitrarily, 90% of them. And so now they have 23 million letters, words, or short phrases. You with me? And they say to you, align this into a book. You have 23 million letters or words. Do you have a question for me? No. You can do it. No. You might want to ask the person, which book? Right? You can't take 23 million letters and arrange them and come out with a book. A computer maybe could, but they can't. So here's the key to the kingdom. They have to put in a template and say, take these 23 million letters, take these 23 million little sequences of RNA and organize them into Hamlet. Or in this case, they put in SARS-CoV-2, the sequence from China. Why did they put that sequence in? Why not measles virus sequence? Because the guy had COVID. And because we found the spike proteins after we put in trypsin. And so we know it was SARS-CoV-2. So we put the genome in, and we say to the computer, match it to that genome, and it does, 99%. And then it makes a few mistakes, and those are the variants.
But they could put measles in there.
They could put measles in there, and they would get measles. And they could put HIV in there and get HIV. And they could put Zika in there. There's enough words and letters and phrases to make any sequence you want. It's all about which template you put in. Because if you put Hamlet in, you can arrange those 23 million letters to make Hamlet. If you put War and Peace, I think, except if you put War and Peace, you might miss a few. And so then you have to add them to the end, which is what they call sophisticated alignment processing. They just add them when the gaps are. And that's the genome. And that's called the complete genome. And that's nuts. And the variants are because, you know, a computer missed a few of them. And anyways, this guy doesn't have the same letters to make the sequence exactly the same. So they fudge it a little bit and get different parts are not 99, they're 98% aligned. And that becomes the variant. Has everybody got it? No, anybody doesn't? Yeah. What? From the first guy who did it in Wuhan. And he got the template from the third guy, and he got it from the second guy, and he got it from the first guy, and he got it because he matched it with SARS-CoV-1 from 2003, which was done exactly the same way, and he got it from matching it with MERS virus in 1997, and this is called in silico genome sequencing. In other words, it only lives in the computer. There is no complete genome in the brew. It cannot be found. 100%. All the virologists agree. You have to align it. You have to cut it into little pieces. Like if you had just phrases, you might not be able to make War and Peace. So you cut it into letters, and then you can make War and Peace. So they cut it into letters, throw out the parts that are French, because we don't want War and Peace in French, and then they use the template, and we're going to show that by putting RNA from yeast and blindly sending it and saying, is this a sample of measles virus? They're going to say it's a sample of measles. Zika, HIV, SARS-CoV-1, and that should be the end of the story. It probably won't, but soon. But the main question that people, I think, have now is, so what makes people sick, right? And even you sometimes see people who in the same place get sick. Now, the first thing I want to say, it's a little bit like when I used to read Sherlock Holmes, and he said, as long as you have a misconception in your mind, there's no room for the reality, the real answer to come in. So whenever you're dealing with, so what causes measles or chickenpox or COVID or something, the first thing that should happen to you is, well, I know it's not a virus. At that point, then you can start trying to find out what it is. Now, I would admit also that we're all at a certain handicap here, because as far as using like published research and actual findings, 99.9% of the money has going into studying the imaginary virus and 0.1% into what really makes people sick. So you're often in a catch-22 where you can't say much because nobody has looked into it. But I think I've come up with a kind of theoretical foundation that will allow us to actually answer that question. And to me, it's a kind of, this may be exaggerated and even arrogant on my part, but it's because I didn't really, none of this is my own. I'm just like the spokesman here. It's this like the unified field theory of disease. And I also want to point out that for anybody who's scientifically minded and oriented and wants to learn more about this, you are not, I would say, even as clear a statement as this, you are not able to understand the issue of what makes people sick on a sort of tissue and cellular, if you want to use that word, level, unless you've read the works of Harold Hillman and Gilbert Ling, because they are instrumental in helping people sort this out. And what I mean by that is the question of what makes us sick is intimately tied up with what are we made of? And because if we can answer that, we can then have a theory as to what actually is going wrong. Now, we have a theory that was And interestingly, there's like this whole thing about viruses cause disease and they inject their DNA into the cell and reproduce and then explode the cell and cause cytopenia. That's called a viral theory, not viral fact, because nobody has seen any parts of it except no virus in the beginning, dead cells, lots of particles at the end. Nobody has seen the spike protein attached to a receptor and inject its business into the cell and reproduce itself and then explode the cell. That nobody has seen. So this is viral theory. And along with that, we have what's called cellular theory. And this was started by a guy named Rudolf Virchow in the 1850s, who broke with the entire tradition of Chinese medicine, shamanic medicine, homeopathic medicine, vitalism, Plato, everything to say that all living things are composed of cells. And since then, we have studied cells, and we look for the cause of disease in a dysfunction of the cell. Now, I had my wife draw a schematic of what a cell looks like. And here are the important points. So according to modern theory, we have a cell membrane, right? Everybody's heard of this, which is a lipid bilayer, a protein, fat, protein sandwich that surrounds the cell. Or it may be a fluid mosaic model. Or it turns out there's 15 different models for what a cell membrane looks like. And as I've liked to say, only one model of what a schnauzer dog looks like, because everybody has seen a schnauzer dog and nobody has seen a lipid bilayer cell membrane. And then it has a nucleus in it that supposedly houses the chromosomes. And it's got mitochondria in it that have cristae inside them. And then it has nuclear pores in the nucleus. And then it has an endoplasmic reticulum, which connects the nucleus and the cell membrane, which is dotted with ribosomes, which are the part where the RNA is made into protein. And then it has a Golgi apparatus that has lysosomes which do cell killing. And I could go on. There's maybe 10 or so other parts of this, of the cell. Now, the first thing I want to point out is if I was to say, I want to understand what your hand is made of and what it does, right? That's our quest. So here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to take your arm, and I'm going to cut your hand off your body, and then I'm going to put it in an enzyme bath to dissolve all the soft tissue, and then I'm going to freeze it to 150 degrees below zero Celsius, and then I'm going to put it in a blender and blend it up, and then I'm going to stain it with heavy metals, and then I'm going to put it under an electron beam to evaporate all the water out of it, and I'm going to look at it under a microscope, and then I'm going to tell you what your hand is made of and what your hand does. How many of you think I would be successful at saying the purpose of your hand is to stroke your child's head? Nobody, because that would be stupid, right? That's called the technique of making an electron microscope picture. They do all those steps to a cell, and that's what they see. And nobody has ever seen a lipid bilayer membrane except by doing that. And all they see is a protein with dots along the outside, which are likely to be heavy metal staining of the protein precipitate. Now, when you read Hillman, which I've done for the last number of months, thousands of pages. Let me take one example of this. The ribosomes. The ribosomes are spherical dots that line the endoplasmic reticulum. This is a very important structure for right now, because all molecular biologists, all cell biologists, all scientists say the ribosomes are the place where RNA is translated, made into protein. If there are no ribosomes, then we have a huge problem with this theory, right? Hillman, in gory hundreds of pages details, documents that every single picture of a ribosome, which started in about 1920, shows it as a perfect circle with a essentially a black circle with a clear interior. Every single published picture of a ribosome since around 1930 is like that. Now, think about that. In order for this electron microscope picture is a two-dimensional picture, right? A circle on a slide. That must mean, if it's a perfect circle, that the ribosome must be spherical in real life, right? And it's lining the endoplasmic reticulum like oranges, and that's where the site of the RNA is made into protein. And everyone is a perfect, so if you imagine this and you have a two-dimensional picture, it would be a perfect circle. But remember, one of the steps in making this picture was to put this into a blender. How many of you, somebody give me the percentage chance that if I put this orange into a blender, every single piece that I would get would be a perfect circle? The answer is exactly zero. In other words, this is an artifact. An artifact means it's make-believe, based on the technique of making electron micrograph pictures. There is no other confirmation that it exists. Therefore, there's no site of making proteins out of mRNA. Now, to take another one, there's a theoretical problem, because the DNA is in the nucleus, right? And the DNA is made, called transcription, into RNA in the nucleus. And then it goes out of this through nuclear pores, circles, that then go to the ribosomes to be translated into protein. This is an intrinsic part of the so-called vaccines. This is the theory that it's based on. So the problem is, we know that the pH in the nucleus is different than the pH outside the nucleus in the cytoplasm. And the reason the pH is different is because the hydrogen ion concentration is different here than here, right? That's the only... Now, a hydrogen ion is thousands of times smaller than a piece of RNA. And every nuclear pore is a perfect circle. And they say, I don't have the visual aid here, it's like the toilet paper roll, right? So you have a toilet paper roll spanning the nuclear membrane, and the RNA goes out of the toilet paper roll into the cytoplasm and goes to the ribosome, which doesn't exist. So here's the problem. First of all, this was homogenized in a blender, and so how are you possible to have everyone be a perfect circle? It's not possible. And second of all, if this is a toilet paper roll, how do you let something as big as an RNA out or in, and yet keep hydrogen ions out or in? There's no possible way that could happen. And we know that the concentration is different here than here. So they realized this, and so they made up different theories. If any of you, I remember when I was a child, I went to New York City and I went to a cafeteria, and they had a this cafeteria, and they had sandwiches going around on conveyor belts, and you put your quarter in, and then you could open up. It's been there for about 2 weeks, the sandwich. And then you could pull it out, and then that's where your sandwich was. So they actually say, well, that's what the nuclear pour is, obviously not the toilet paper roll. It's this conveyor belt thing, which has never been seen. And it somehow there's some signal to open it up, and the RNA goes in there, and then it goes around in a conveyor belt and deposits it in the cytoplasm, and there's some signal to let it out. And that's the theory as to how that works to get them out of this. Not one part of that has ever been documented. And even if you open up the sandwich thing, how do you keep the hydrogen ions from going into the sandwich thing? There is no possible way this can work. And he went on like this for 50 years saying, none of this is real. This is make-believe biology. And that's the basis of our science and how we understand health and disease. And at the end of the day, the only thing you can show that's real without doing strange techniques so you could see things is we have a very thin layer and we have organized, coherent water in the tissues or cells. Now, let me clarify that. According to normal medicine, we have approximately 888 different tissues, like ovaries and skin and hair and et cetera. 48 of them are called syncytium, which means there's no compartments at all. They're just it's like blocks of jello stacked next to each other. Are those cells or do they have a membrane? Not really. They're just jello stacked next to each other. And some of them, it's just a big bowl of jello. And the liquid in there is not liquid water like we were told in medical school. Otherwise, you would be sloshing around. And otherwise, like when I was an ER doctor, I've seen people bayoneted and stabbed and shot. You know how many times I saw water squirting out of their leg? None. There's no water in there. It's gel. It's organized, coherent water. And in that organized, coherent water, which ends in a kind of thicker membrane, there's lipids, good fats, there's minerals, there's amino acids, there's nucleotides dissolved in that. There's also mitochondria that have no cristae inside. That's an artifact. They make ATP, which is misconceived of as energy, and I don't want to get into that, but that's not true. But they're old bacteria that have merged with us. So there's organized water with all this stuff in it, with a fat membrane around it, and a nucleus which seems to house some DNA. And that's it. And that is it. And so the way this works is, so this is the key to the understanding of the whole COVID, what's time is it? 20 of, okay. Oh, okay, no problem. This is the key to understanding the entire COVID-19 hit. So, in other words, the only thing you can literally prove exists is a compartment or not. Some tissues, like the lens of your eye, there's no compartments. It's just organized crystalline water. And the type of crystalline water that it is meant to be transparent to your light in the lens of your eye. So it uses certain fats, certain minerals, certain proteins to achieve that end. When that works well, you have a lens that's transparent to the light and you can see. If you start disorganizing it and making it hardened, wrong fats, wrong minerals, it solidifies And we call that a cataract. That's the origin of disease. The same thing in your knee. You have a bone, which is itself a kind of organized crystal, organized water crystal. And then you have these two bursa, which are gel crystalline water sacs. And here's the other thing you need to know. All gel coherent, these are structured crystalline water, is negatively charged. So you have two negatively charged sacs opposing each other. They repel, and just the fact that they're gels makes easy sliding motion. And then you have a fully functional knee. If you disorganize the gel, it liquefies, and then you have a swollen knee that sticks together, and we call that bone-on-bone osteoarthritis. That's the origin of the disease. If you have stuff dissolved in your gel of the lining of your lungs so that you can't make the perfect crystal, because think of it, the crystal, okay, back up. And here's the game we're playing here. There's two possible crystalline structures in nature. There's water, and it is holographic. In other words, the tiniest coherent water crystal is the same as the entire crystal. It has an infinite number of surfaces, and so it accepts any influence from the outside and changes its crystalline nature. And that's why it's the basis of life. So it accepts thoughts and feelings and hormones and chemicals and lipids and amino acids. And each time it changes itself, and I would say towards the evolutionary goal of being the perfect, you might even say Christ consciousness crystal, that's the game that humans are playing. And insofar as you evolve towards the perfection of the water crystal in your tissues, you become healthier and healthier, and you're like a radio that can receive more and more signals. You hear feelings, and you hear thoughts, and you hear chemicals, and you hear everything in the world. And each time you hear something, you subtly change and either become more perfect, or you have now a poison grape dissolved in your jello, and then you have to make an inflammatory reaction called sickness, and we call that mucus and cough, etc., to get that thing out, and that's the only way it can happen. You got a poison grape dissolved in your bronchial tissue. It's interfering. Now you have an out-of-tune radio. You can't tolerate that because the game we're playing is perfection of our crystal. You get it out by the only way that a living system can get that out, dissolve it, excrete it with the mucus, and then you're better, which is what we say about children. They get measles because they have something like almost, in that case, generic to children. It's a maturation process that they somehow can even signal to one another, like women who are menstruating, signal to each other, it's time to synchronize your menses. You, child, this is a maturation process which will make you better for life. And they send out a bioenergetic or some sort of signal we don't know yet that signals you to do this process, and we know for a fact you are better for life. Less diseases, less cancer, less diabetes, less arthritis. That's why things seem to be spread, because there's a universal experience, maturation process, and then there's a bioenergetic, we don't know exactly, communication device between people to tell them, now it's time to go through this. And that explains everything you see. Now, the other alternative, the other crystalline structure in nature is quartz. Also, holographic, infinite number of binding surfaces. And interestingly, stable for millions of years, right? Nothing will happen to it. You can download millions of bits of information onto these surfaces of the quartz crystal. That's why it's the basis of computers. Silicon Valley. This is a quartz-based stable system of downloading infinite number of information. And here's the difference. Quartz never can grow or feel or evolve. It just adds more and more bits of information. And you could say, well, isn't that a good thing that we live a million years? Why isn't life based on quartz? Because you can't feel and you can't be in grief and you can't have pain and you can't grow, and I don't want any part of that. And that is exactly the agenda here, to make life, from transferring it from a water-based system that evolves, grows, and changes, to everything will be quartz in silico genome. The virus only lives in the computer. Our currency only lives in the computer. Your ability to go to the bar lives in the computer. They're injecting you with pieces of sequences of toxic proteins to try to get you to make these proteins. This is in silico quartz-based biology. That is the transhumanistic agenda. That is the choice we have to make. Do you want to be a water-based that you can feel and you can get sick and you can grieve and you can love and you can think and you can evolve and you can make of yourself what your consciousness wants? Or do you want to be controlled from the outside by a quartz-based, adding more and more information as you go? And I think you can see that from this model, that all we are is water and some stuff in it, and you got to have the right minerals, and you got to have the right lipids, and you got to have the right amino acids. And by the way, one of the proofs of this is, so ribosomes don't exist. Where does the DNA get transcribed into RNA? How does it get out of the nucleus? There's no holes in the membrane. There's no receptors in the imaginary lipid bilayer membrane. Now, hear what I just said there, because of all the wacky things I've said about medicine and biology, I just said there's no receptors. You know those ACE2 receptors? You know those opiate receptors? You know those serotonin receptors, which 90% of our pharmaceutical drugs are based on? Those are receptors like this that supposedly span the membrane, which have never been seen. All you see is a smooth line with dots on both sides, exactly what you would get if you put a protein and then you put heavy metal dyes in there, and the heavy metal dyes line both sides just like you would expect, and that's what you see. And then they say, well, the reason you don't see it is because the enzymes that we put in there, they dissolve the receptors. So why don't you see a hole? There's no hole. This is all theoretical biology. What we have is organized water with stuff in it and a nucleus, and we don't know how this works to get the things out. But I can tell you that one of the proofs of this is they do the Human Genome Project. So back up. DNA makes RNA makes protein, right? That's the basis of our genetic dogma. It's called the central dogma. And if there's no protein, that it's not made and coded for by a DNA, right? That's what they say. Now, they do the Human Genome Project. You know how many genes they found? 20,000. You know how many proteins there are in a human being? About 250,000 plus. By the way, we have fewer genes than a Drosophilus fruit fly, or a worm, or an apple. So how do 20,000 genes code for 250,000 proteins? Silence. The whole thing is nonsense. The proteins, believe it or not, are made de novo, means anew, by the interaction of consciousness or electromagnetic fields. And here you can now begin to understand the number one thing that scrambles your water crystal, which is organized by the interaction of minerals, lipids, proteins with the sun and the moon and your dog, most dogs, and your friends, and holding hands and smiling at people and hearing people and talking to people and your own thoughts and what your aspirations are in life. That's what the energetic impulse from the world working with this water crystal to create you. If you put in a man-made pulsed electromagnetic field, you've got a scrambled, incoherent water crystal like a radio that just hears static. And that is the problem. There you go.